Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the musical delight, Dr. James. And thank you for everyone for joining as we have another session of our journal club. You know, it's been 2 weeks since we last talked. And in that time, a lot of things have happened. So let's move forward. If you would go to the next slide. And we could go ahead and hit the agenda. So today, as usual, we're gonna go through the COVID-19 state of the state. And then we're going to get into a discussion that I've been really looking forward to with Elizabeth Brower, I believe, am I saying your name correct? And hopefully, you know, depending on where that conversation leads us, hopefully we'll have time for an open discussion. So the first thing that, you know, like I said, a lot has happened in the last 2 weeks. And I was reflecting on that this morning and last night, and just thinking about where we started and where we thought we were going even 2 weeks ago and where we're at now. So this is from the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 site, and the total cases worldwide is over 11.8 million. When we look at the United States, This snapshot was taken at about 9:34 this morning, and they're reporting over 2.9 million cases in the United States. On the Worldometer, which is a site that I look at as well, they're stating that we're already over 3 million. So a tiny bit of variability in those numbers, but it all depends on how you're counting and what you're counting. So I think everything will align by this evening. What that means for the United States is that we're over 130,000 deaths. And, you know, looking back at this whole experience, 117 days in, you know, if you just take a look back even at our own journal clubs, on the 24th, we were in the state of Florida, we were at 100,000, 103,000 cases. If you go to the next slide, as of this morning, we were at 223,000 plus cases. And what that means that when you look, if you're ever on the Department of Health's website for Florida or Johns Hopkins, you could go county by county and see what the trends are, the population of that county, the demographics of the county. And if you look at Miami-Dade right now, the cases are greater than 53,000. And where I live in Broward County, we're over 22,000. So in that short period of 2 weeks, we've seen a doubling of the cases and then some in the state of Florida. We do know that this trend is not isolated to Florida. We're seeing it in Texas and California and Arizona and some other states. So It put a somber note on the activities of the weekend this past 4th of July. And it made me really think about where we really need to go and what we're doing. If you go to the next slide, this is just the projection. And it's been a couple of weeks since we really delved into it. The reason why I wanted us to take a look at it again is because on this site, they're looking at not only hospital resources and deaths, but infection trends. And what I like that they've done recently is that on top of the projection numbers, which you may not appreciate here, the purple line is projection. What they've done is, and you could play around with this, they looked at what would happen and what the projections would be if we eased back and reopened more things versus if we have universal masking. And I thought it was really interesting because it definitely tells a different story when you think about where we're at in this country and the unfortunate politics that have emerged around this. But just to think about if we as scientists and clinicians and nurses, if we think about where we want to go, I think that this tells a very interesting story. The next slide is that same projections, just looking at daily deaths. And then the one that we are most familiar with is the hospital resources. And if you go to that slide, which is the next one, you'll see the huge amount of variability as we project out beyond July and August. You know, so there's still, as some of the scientific leaders have said, there's still so much variability. There's still a lot that we have to do. And it really, I think, sort of sets up this conversation that we're gonna have today around how do we operationalize this? How have we been doing? What are we doing? And where do we go from here? So with that, you know, I wanna get into our speaker. So if we can move forward, we're gonna talk to Elizabeth Rohr, who is a Senior VP of Clinical Operations for Greystone Health. And Liz, I'll have you introduce yourself to the group and maybe explain your picture.
Yes, absolutely. Again, thank you for the invite. It's a pleasure and I'm honored to be able to be part of this journal today with you all. Kind of sensitive subject, of course, and on everybody's mind, and how can we better partner with one another. So my name is Elizabeth Bohr. I am the Senior Vice President of Clinical Operations for Greystone Health Network. I started with the company in 2007. I've been with them all the way through. I had a hiatus of about 2 years, moving on to a clinical quality specialist position, just gaining oversight on QAPI and things like that for a pretty big portfolio of 82 facilities. So again, Greystone Health Network, we have 30 facilities in the state of Florida and spans out to 13 facilities, both in Illinois and Missouri. I've been tasked with really being that go-to person for the organization from the activation of our GEMS, Greystone Emergency Management System, way back at the beginning of time, really communicating and coordinating efforts with COVID from the beginning.
So, and we thank you for joining us today, and thank you for answering the call to come out and speak to us about what you've been experiencing. Ian, if you could go to the next slide, what I want us to start with is something that Liz, you shared with me today, and you sort of, when I read through this letter that you sent to your staff, you know, not only did I have to find the box of tissues, I had to just rethink about how we were going to approach this conversation. So I wanted you to maybe start with describing to us what a day in the life of a CNA is like now, the nurses, that experience, and how you and your team have been coping with all of that.
So absolutely. I think from the beginning, right when this really started, and I want to say end of January, mid-February, we started with education on cover your cough and hand hygiene and things like that. I don't think that we could over-communicate or over-educate to how to protect ourselves and how to protect our residents that we serve in our long-term care centers. So a big piece of that is, you know, what they're challenged with, even in a COVID-free building, in the day-to-day, and what that looks like from the screening process as mandated and as directed by the Agency for Healthcare Administration, along with Surgeon General Rivkes and the Department of Health, as far as screening our staff. So really what that looks like when you walk into the facility, our staff have been tasked with bringing in a clean set of clothes, zipped in a bag, they enter through, they go ahead and they go through the screening process. They stand in line to make sure that they change out of their clothes to make sure that any chance of transmission is reduced at that point in time for our asymptomatic staff that may exist in the community that a screening may not capture. up to the point where we have a lot of residents that upon admission, we place on a 14-day preventative droplet precaution. So with that, of course, we have to be shielded and masked and gowned and, you know, on and doff the PPE consistently. So if I'm that staff member that is working in the COVID-free building, even on those units, the amount of heat that exists from working as a CNA on the floor, caring for patients, providing ADL care, it's very, very hard to put into words. And I can say that because, you know, even me being in my position, whether that's selfishly or not, having the opportunity to be able to work as a CNA through this COVID journey, both in the Midwest and in the state of Florida, having to don and doff the PPE for 12, 16 hours and work side by side with my staff to make sure that they get it done. When we talk about staffing contingency plans and things like that. Now let's talk about our buildings that are plagued with COVID, whether it's one case, whether it's a staff member that has a potential exposure, we go ahead and we carry out a post-potential exposure plan, which exists. It could affect up to 40 to 50 people on contact and droplet precautions, again, in their day-to-day. So really, truly understanding infection control practices, not only on the proactive side, but understanding our staff of what they go through in their day-to-day to get them to a point where they're not cutting corners. That's number one, right? And they don't cut corners because they want to be able to provide the best care that they can. So it's from our standpoint that we have to continue to educate them on making sure that they are cleaning that shield with an EPA wipe in between each and every resident, and then just taking into consideration what that looks like for them. And then for the rest of their day, you know, doffing their clothes, changing into their clothes that they came in from home with before they leave, and going home to their families and their loved one with the potential exposure day to day, and they get up in the morning and they do it again. So really understanding that first and foremost, and then understand how do we, as leaders in the building, proactively start to approach that. Number one, to give them a sense of security. They are protected the most in our setting than they are out in the community. And how do we translate, how does that translate to decrease that fear in their minds to take this home to their families? I think that's where it starts off, is really understanding the capacity of what our caregivers are doing on the front lines.
What has been the impact to the workforce in your chain of facilities, your fleet, as you would call it?
Well, I think one of the biggest impacts is that people become fearful. You know, we go through an N95 questionnaire with obviously some people that are capable and not capable of wearing an N95 mask. So I thank everyone on the call for being part of that process. Our medical directors, really that screening piece to see whether they need to be referred to their primary. And so we've lost staff there, here and there, just based upon that. Secondary, those that for agency usage, when we have a building that has potential exposure, whether that's a new admission or a staff, asymptomatic staff member, now that we've shifted to a cyclic every 2-week testing throughout the state of Florida, I mean, you have asymptomatic carriers. So therefore, when we look at contact tracing, what does that look like for the impact of staff? I think that we've done as an organization a really phenomenal job in being able to set those staffing contingency plans in place right from the beginning. But again, when you have buildings in the Miami area that that did have a high increase of COVID at two of our facilities down in the Miami area, I can tell you that that the medical directors there really, really, both Dr. Del Prado and Dr. Durandis really just partnering with those leadership teams of both of those buildings have been amazing. So the staffing piece, we currently have some issues with the needs for the Department of Health needing more staff. So therefore, the recruiting in the communities and offering a lot of money for staff to go and work in those hot zones, and they want to be part of helping people. I think that that's been a little bit of an impact and a challenge for us. People going to get very high significant wages to go work for the Department of Health and, you know, leaving us to kind of try to solve for that. So that's been a number two issue with staffing. And then how do we navigate through that 14-day quarantine when we do have that contact tracing that leads back to maybe 10 staff members? And that's when the department heads step up. That's when our regional clinicians, our regional operators step up, those that hold licensure to go in there to help support that building through that quarantine and through that moment in time.
So when you are going to your facilities in Florida, Illinois, and Missouri, are you taking a hands-on approach, working those shifts that we may not be able to staff for?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
So if we, you know, I wanted to talk about just what you guys did. You mentioned it earlier about how you operationalized and started sounding the alarm early. How did you activate your emergency preparedness policies? What did you do then for PPE, and what are you doing now to assure that if you're going through, you're not burning through your PPE too fast?
Well, I have to say we really got a jump start right in the beginning. You know, I thank our chief clinical officer for that. You know, really, really starting to read between the lines, really even before the state shut down for visitors. So, you know, we activated our Greystone Emergency Management System, which is in place for not only for hurricane preparedness and part of our emergency plan. We activated that. We got all of our executive directors on the call daily, going through not only how many residents are on droplet, how many residents are on precautions as a whole, how many of those, how many gowns do we have in inventory, how many gloves, how many booties, any of the needs that we need for PPE. Our chief financial officer has been tallying that in a spreadsheet, and day after day we've calculated as a team the PPE, the burn rate. I think we were able to get in front of it and get a vast amount of supplies. We did not have to shift to makeshift equipment, luckily. I'm very grateful for that. We were able to always have, whether it's a washable gown or disposable gown in our buildings that have been affected by COVID, you know, having your washable gown, putting a disposable gown over top of it when treating patients with droplet or contact precautions. And really, I think that activation really got getting in front of it. When we started to see a shortage, we struggled a bit, but I think that we had hubs set up right from the beginning in different areas of our Florida and our Midwest, where we had a hub centralized location in one of our larger facilities in each one. So three in the state of Florida and two in the state of Illinois to Missouri, and where we had ample amount of PPE that we were able to get from that hub and bring it to anyone that was struggling with maybe disposable gowns and gloves and masks, surgical masks for that matter. But again, we never had to shift to a makeshift type of PPE, and that's how we did it. We really just started early and ordered an abundance that we could.
Okay, what has been the impact that you've seen for your facilities with the Department of Health? Were they assisting, or do they now assist with ordering PPE or making sure you have adequate testing? What has been your experience? And I know that there's variability from state to state and county to county, and maybe you could enlighten us on how that has been for such a large organization.
Yes, absolutely. There's been a lot of variance, and I think that, you know, we're working towards that partnership with Florida Healthcare. They've been amazing at you know, Florida Healthcare Association. They've been amazing at really filtering through a lot of information from all parties, from the Agency for Healthcare Administration, from the CDC, the World Health Organization, and the Department of Health. They've been able to filter through all of those things, supply us with a lot of data. So I'm very thankful for them. But when we're looking at buildings that are affected in different areas, you know, the Stark area versus the Miami area, the EOC has been phenomenal at getting us supplies for sure. You know, added supplies to our current inventory, so they have been supportive. early on, the National Guard did help with one of our facilities up in the northern part that had two cases, right when it was early in its infancy stage. As we know now, over the last couple of weeks, a lot of facilities across the state of Florida have been affected. So a lot of support right off the bat with that facility. As we shifted towards, the hot spot in Miami, there wasn't a lot of support. I could tell you that up in the north, we had the Department of Health bringing us test kits, making sure that we're proactively swabbing all of the residents in right a rapid turnaround in order for us to follow those pillars of identification, containment, isolation, treatment, and tracking and trending. It's very difficult in the Miami area just due to the abundance of cases. So the Department of Health really wasn't that supportive because they had so many other cases that they were dealing with. So when we talk about availability of testing, that wasn't available. We had some things that were set up that never came to fruition where we had to, utilize our own resources through our own lab vendors to get that done with a little bit of a longer turnaround. Different variances as far as the direction goes, from when we have one instance in one case, there's been direction that we need to close the door as far as airflow goes and throughout the whole facility. And then we've had other areas where Agency for Healthcare Administration says for psychosocial purposes, we should have the doors open. Other Department of Health have said that N95s are not needed outside of the specific COVID unit, only inside the COVID unit, whereas other Department of Health have said the minute you have a case, you need to activate your N95s, and everyone should be donning an N95. There's been cases where the Department of Health have come in to help assist with testing and have not doffed the appropriate PPE and participated in the screening because once they've donned their PPE, they don't want to remove it. So they've been sanitizing their gloves in between caring for patients to obtain those types of samples, which as we know in practice doesn't really seem right. Still trying to get some information or some collateral to the justification of that directive. Whereas other departments of health have been fully geared, go through our screening process as far as monitoring the SpO2, going through the screening, they doff their gloves, they re-don gloves after performing hand hygiene, and have been very supportive of our screening process. So a little confusing trying to navigate through the direction of each department of health, who is there to support us and really take the lead from them. And then from this mile high view of having the 30 facilities and getting that response to what we do as an organization go above the standard at times we have done. And then what do we do when we have a variance?
So just out of curiosity, what does redonning gloves look like? just in my mind, that just seems so opposite of everything I've ever learned. And I don't know if anyone else, is doing that kind of process, but can you enlighten us on, how do you do that,
So what I mean is just a matter of, so they've come in, they've done the screening, they've doffed their gloves, they've performed hand hygiene, and then they don new gloves. Let me.
Okay.
So they don new gloves. The confusing part has been the Department of Health that have come in fully donned in gear and have not taken them off in between patients. They've hand sanitized their gloves in between obtaining samples to assist the facilities with facility-wide testing. They do not take their gloves off. They hand sanitize their gloves that they've donned before they've come into the centers. That has been the direction from their particular Department of Health, yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, wow. So just so I don't get stuck there, because that's still playing out in my head. How have you managed, when there is those situations? We've talked a lot about being COVID-free, having a COVID-free facility. Can you shed some light on how you're actually managing outbreaks, and if it's ever possible to achieve, in your opinion, a COVID-free status?
Absolutely. I can tell you that one of our facilities in Miami, our North Beach facility, they did have a high prevalence of cases. They were able to work through that systematically with their regional nurse consultants in conjunction with the Department of Health. We are now COVID-free at that building. It was an early on outbreak. And then another one of our facilities that did have a high prevalence of both asymptomatic and symptomatic residents and staff. They're now down to 3 residents being treated in-house with COVID-19 from a very high number. So just my hats off to the 2 of those buildings and managing through that. There's a lot of things that do come up. Again, it's education to the staff, especially those that are working strictly on the COVID units. It's managing our residents that are not currently active with COVID on the adjacent wings, and how do we keep that separated so we don't have an increase in cases. It's making sure that we've increased our monitoring to every 4 hours for all vital signs, SpO2, working with the medical directors and the primary physicians to be able to identify a deviation in anything, quickly get a chest x-ray, quickly monitor them, we know how to be able to properly care for those patients as well as isolate. Again, I think that there's a large variance to what that looks like from our vendor perspective, that screening, our phlebotomists that come in, our x-ray techs, our ARMPs, our vendors, you know, participating in that screening and making sure that they too are maintaining infection control from resident to resident. The quicker that education goes out and the quicker we're able to communicate that with all parties involved, we're able to decrease the prevalence of the cases and move to a COVID-free standpoint. I think all of those elements together really contribute to that. Being proactive, if I may, like from the medical director's perspective, I think that we've had some incredible physicians that have participated, especially in the Pinellas County, with coming in and doing education with our nursing, licensed nursing staff, as far as how to better understand respiratory change of condition, and what are those things to be able to document in our SBAR and communicate to our primary physicians immediately, and be able to identify and isolate so that contact tracing, if there is a prevalence, is decreased. I think that is the caveat to getting in front of a full-out outbreak. And containing it to 1 to 2 to 3 patients or even an asymptomatic staff member. We have had some facilities that have had asymptomatic residents, maybe 1 or 2, and our ability to quickly navigate through that. And as I mentioned, through isolating and isolating the whole, anyone that has on the largest assignment from a caregiver that could have breached infection control. So if patient X comes up positive, anyone that would have had contact with patient X goes on isolation for 14 days and strict, you know, infection control is carried out. We've been able to minimize.
Delivering true excellence in post-acute medicine requires more investment, resources, and infrastructure than ever before. U.S. Post-Acute Care, a physician-led practice group, has built a business model dedicated to providing high-quality post-acute patient care on a national scale. We make it easy and beneficial for regional practices to leverage our resources to drive the growth and quality of their practices. Visit our website at uspostacutecare.com to see for yourself. Together, we'll be stronger.
So we had a question that came in. Can you give us a rough estimate on how many COVID positive patients you've had in all of your fleet thus far?
A whole fleet, I don't have that number right in front of me. We've had so many that have recovered. Like I said, the Miami area had a majority of cases. I don't have those whole numbers right in front of me. I definitely could get that to you. I know that it is listed publicly. But for the most part, out of all 30 facilities looking at Florida alone, with the exception of those 3 facilities that have had outbreaks, you're looking at less than 2% of positive return. I know that for sure, for the remaining of our buildings. Taking that out of the element, our 2 Miami buildings and the one in the St. Pete area currently.
And another question that came through was, what has contract tracing revealed for your populations?
I could say it's varied. We've drilled down one, again, to potential. Again, we're waiting for confirmation as we go through this contact tracing with the Department of Health. But I could say the phlebotomists, we've screened them. And you know, it's really going back to what is their technique for their bag? What are they doing with their bag? Are they bringing that from room to room to room? We are utilizing the appropriate EPA cleaning materials. That's another thing to really look into when we're looking at facilities. People forget that as far as environmental. What is the chemical we're using to clean these rooms from room to room? So we've had the chemical in place. It's really taking a look at that early morning lab draw, those stat labs, you know, the lab provider coming in, doing that screening on them, making sure they're wearing appropriate PPE, but what about their equipment? We can educate them all day long, but how frequently are we doing visual observations of their technique from both the x-ray company, from our ARNPs or our physicians that come in that do frequent other facilities, and what are they doing with that equipment? Are they cleaning their shield from room to room for those, and I'm talking those that may not even have COVID that are on preventative isolation, and then we later find out that they're now positive. So it has varied from potentially an asymptomatic staff member. It's varied from our dialysis patients that we do have on isolation. We are only cohorting dialysis patients if they frequent the same dialysis center. They've had a lot of outbreaks at dialysis centers, so taking that into consideration, that had been a vehicle potentially in one of our buildings. So it's been a mixture of the three, really. New admissions that come in, we're making sure that they are on pretty solid precautions for 14 days. You know, and as long as we're maintaining our universal masking and we're maintaining our PPE, we've had good outcomes. But as far as the contact tracing goes, it's either been from a staff member, a provider, or from a vendor.
So when you mentioned providers, have any of your facilities limited access to any clinicians during this period?
Yes, we have. Definitely in the beginning right away, as we started to flatten the curve, we made sure that if it was essential and the visit was essential, and as we moved towards the telehealth portion of this, you know, we did utilize that a lot from our wound rounds perspective through Vora. And when we needed to utilize the telehealth, we did that a lot. Dental, we made sure it was only for dental emergencies only. And again, right from the beginning, that they were screened and donned appropriate PPE when they're coming in. Some of the clinical providers might not have been the physician if they're going, especially if they have a practice out in the community, to make sure that risk is decreased. Because again, partnership throughout our community, not just in our setting, but to make sure that they weren't exposed into their practice out in the community, that we did utilize the virtual visits a lot. We did have ARNPs and PAs in the building for those that have had a decline that needed that essential visit. Again, we had a practitioner that was going in between three different facilities, screening them appropriately. They wound up testing positive on a rapid test, which affected all three buildings. As far as a potential response plan, luckily she had the nasopharyngeal swab, it came back negative. So it's kind of a false positive rapid test. We immediately responded and nobody was affected by that, but definitely our response plan was in place. So the potential was there for that one, but again, she wound up being negative.
And you mentioned the medical director's role, like that if we want to achieve an ability to keep our facilities free of the virus, that we have to be proactive. What has been your experience in working with the medical directors? How has the role of that medical director evolved during this period for your organization?
So it's varied a little bit. I think for the most part, a large percentage of our medical directors have been amazing through this. There's been some that, you know, even quite recently with the testing are refusing to have the 2-week testing done. So we're dealing with that and just a very isolated, you know, 1 to 2 buildings with them not wanting to be tested. And it's oral. So it's not even a, as far as the fear from being, you know, poked at every 2 weeks. And I think the state's done a really great job at providing us with these oral swabs. But for the most part, we've had some that have been proactive in, like I said, educating our licensed nursing staff on respiratory assessment. Number two, education and being, you know, the response piece for families and the communication for those that are fearful. It's something when you get a call from the medical director and or the attending physician to our families, and we've had some pretty phenomenal providers that have lent that additional support. It decreases, not only potential for media exposure and hype from family members being fear. I mean, they're scared. They haven't seen their loved ones in months. My heart goes out to them every day that those that have been in there day in, day out, caring for their loved ones and seeing them, that they can't see them anymore, right? We've made it the availability of FaceTime and through the window by putting the numbers of their rooms outside so they could have that through the window visit. So when the medical directors and the practitioners are able to really, especially when we've had an outbreak, reach out, that outreach to have that communication with those family members that just need that conversation with some of the that they trust other than the building. Because when media gets a hold of it, it's, there's a lot of false pretenses in what we do. And that's understandable, right? They don't really know what's really going on in the building and how proactive that we've been and how serious this virus is. So that hype that happens and that sense of fear that sets in, when our providers have stepped up and called them and said, hey, listen, you know, I saw your loved one through virtual. This is what the facility is doing to make sure that either your loved one does not acquire it or it doesn't become affected from the virus. Or if your loved one was affected, this is how we're monitoring them. And that has really, truly been instrumental in the decrease and the feeling of trust in us is that partnership in communicating with our families.
I would imagine that if we're having those conversations, there's a lot of discussions around advanced care planning. Yes. What has been your observation as to what the clinical providers are either doing well or could do more of in regards to advanced care planning?
I think right now, because we've been operating on emergency mode, right? And we had a little bit of a lull. We do a psychosocial screening. Our social workers do check that weekly, just based upon the decrease in activities and the increase in the one-to-one activities that we've been doing. So we do address their psychosocial needs weekly. But as far as advanced care planning, and those decisions, right off the beginning, we had conversations with both our residents and our families to talk about if something should happen and your loved one should fall sick or you should fall sick, what does that look like as far as transfer out to a higher level of care if we can't manage your needs within the center? The medical directors have been a part of that, as well as the providers in the community in that advanced care planning. I think that we could do a better job proactively before there's an outbreak from that standpoint in that partnership to really get with the leadership of the building, the director of nursing and the ED, and say, hey, you know what, have you addressed advanced care planning? You know, so it's not, again, DEFCON 10, and we have issues where, you know, people are fearful. Do they want them to stay in the facility? And they're made to make this decision right away. So I think that overall, that we could do a better job proactively, probably across the healthcare continuum with those decisions before there's an outbreak. I think we've done a good job at it, right off the bat from doing that proactively, but I can assume there has been some buildings where maybe it wasn't 100% or the physicians weren't part of that. It was just mostly the clinical staff, which, you know, they go ahead and they decide, no, I want my loved one treated. And then later on, you know, having some second guesses is maybe they should have treated in place and provided comfort measures only and so forth.
So I have a question, and that was posed in the chat as well. Given the emergence of within the state of Florida, these dedicated COVID-19 facilities, what do you imagine that the the impact of now sending people away from the facility that they know to these other facilities with other staff and other things. What is your opinion or your thoughts around that?
I think that we too, as a company, we talked about that as far as what that looks like for a dedicated wing. I know there's a few in the Miami area. I can say that we haven't had to do that, send our patients to one of those facilities. I think that their partnership to make sure that they partner with the hospitals to make sure that we free up beds and availability is an excellent idea that the state came up with for sure. I haven't had experience in that piece because we haven't had to send anybody to those facilities willing to do that. We do have a facility that we do have a dedicated COVID unit that we are taking into consideration for the future, potentially for something like that. But from a psychosocial standpoint and communicating with the loved ones and families of those that we may have an isolated case, I could foresee that coming up in the future. And what would that look like in communicating to the families and then to the receiving facility of taking their loved one from one SNF to the next, and to make sure that that environmental change goes with the shift. And as we all know, that there sometimes is a decline when there is that environmental shift. So as a company, I know that we're sheltering in place, providing the care necessary from staffing to PPE, just to safety. So if we had to utilize that, then that would be my recommendation, that psychosocial piece in that from both levels, that it goes on without a hitch, that transition and what that looks like.
Now, I have wanted to ask you some questions around visitation. We're seeing in other states where this has become like a very popular concern. We want to get back to operating with normal visitation hours for the families and for the residents of these facilities. Can you share with us what your opinion and thought and maybe even policies around visitation are shaping up to look like, given that we're still in this and we're still seeing rising numbers?
Well, I think that I can tell you that in our Illinois area, they've already, they call it Reopen Illinois. There's different phases, just as Florida has done. We've actually gone to a place where if the facility has not exhibited any COVID over the last 28 days, that would be a cycle of 2 14-day isolation, that they're free from that if they previously had COVID within the center. So it's outdoor visitations. We do have a structure laid out through the state of Illinois that they have to be 6 feet apart. They have to have masks on. There has to be a chaperone of some sort. So we do have staff dedicated. There has to be a schedule. Notifications 24 hours prior to that visitation. I could say up to this point, after we've been doing that for the last couple of weeks in Illinois, we haven't had, knock on wood, any cases that have come up from it. So I think that, looking towards the future, it's going to be good as we transition that in the state of Florida. But at this point, with our rising cases in Florida, it is scary. People out in the community still not wearing masks, and for these visitors to potentially bring that into our community. So I think that we're thinking at it as a company for the state of Florida, different ideas as far as we've seen all over the internet, different plexiglass or types of PVC stations that we're looking at. We're also looking at UV light installation, which I think our company has really been pretty proactive with that. We're currently setting priority buildings in place to put the UV light throughout the facilities, because again, this, I feel like this isn't going anywhere or going away anytime soon. So what do we do, especially now with the new scuttlebutt from the World Health Organization that airborne cannot be ruled out? Some pretty scary stuff. So what can we do proactively to get there? I think the UV light is going to be a big piece of that. So any takeaway from this would be to suggest that also into your own facilities. And what that looks like, their capabilities financially and so forth, enable to be able to do that, the UV light. So facility visits, it's been a struggle, but I think that, you know, we have a lot of team members here at the corporate office as well that are helping with navigating through that with families that are just still upset or, you know, it's just as the days go on, it's getting harder and harder for them. I look forward to that shift of being able to protect both us and them with some sort of a, like I said, a station, as you will, maybe in an outside setting that we can start to transition full visitation.
Sure. You mentioned earlier about vendors having proper PPE when they're going from resident to resident. Has there been any other restrictions that you've had to place on different vendors so that where maybe they're not allowed to come into the facility at that time, you know, or a restricted time for them to come and draw blood work or anything like that?
No, I think that we've gotten on top of it with our competencies and making sure that there's somebody with them during the rounding for blood draws or with them during that x-ray that's really necessary and needed. The things that are not essential, we've stopped. Any other vendors, we've made sure that they've signed off an acknowledgement, number one, if we do have any cases or any PUIs or clusters, and number two, that they're aware of their risk. Same thing that if we do have an outbreak, we notify all of our vendors, every one of them in writing, via letter, let them know that there's a potential exposure if they've been in our center. But for the most part, I think that we have a solid screening process in place, and it's just going to be a matter of maintaining that visual observation and competencies of those that are considered essential.
Yeah. And we talked about the challenges of variability and variance. So what I would like in the time that we have left, and definitely to give us some questions, and if you could go to the next slide, what I would like to just maybe if you could share, where do we go from here? Like, what more do we need to be doing? What do we as clinical providers, how do we work best with our facilities?
I think being part of that QAPI process, you know, really, when we look at things that come up, the feedback from you as providers, you may get different ideas and direction in the community that affects our hospital setting that we may not know. The communication of maybe treatment, as well as again, and education is a big piece. There's something to be said when your medical director and your providers are providing that education, then our clinical educator and our staff development that hear over and over again of things that we need to do to keep ourselves safe. So I think that remaining proactive, talking to staff about how to better protect themselves in the community, that truly is going to be the biggest piece. And I think coming from a provider, it does help. You know, when you go out to the store and you're hitting that keypad on that gas pump, or you're putting your debit card in and you go to push that, how many times do we personally as clinicians go out and there's no sanitizer right next to it, but yet I can only have a maximum of 5 people in the 7-Eleven, but you have every one of those people touching that keypad. You know, it bewilders me. So it's really, how do we educate the staff themselves in the community to protect them from bringing it into our most vulnerable population in our buildings? That's number one. Advanced care planning, being really truly part of that, and then the psychosocial support. How can we provide that in the ongoing communication with our families and for them to be there through our QA meetings, through our QA process, and just really soliciting your knowledge and your skill set into what we do in our day-to-day practice due to that level of respect and just that partnership that we have.
Thank you. I will open it up to anyone and everyone who may have questions for Liz.
Hi, Diane, this is Joe Auslander.
Hi, Dr. Auslander.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for the insights. I have a question about the testing that you're doing. This was in Illinois, correct?
The testing we're doing in the state of Florida every 2 weeks, cyclic.
Okay. Yep. Okay. And are you using the curative test?
Yes, we are.
And how are you doing the test?
Meaning?
Well, meaning is a trained staff member administering the test, or are you giving it to staff to take the swabs themselves?
So whether it's a nasopharyngeal swab, we have competencies for the licensed practitioner. So whether that might be the director of nursing, the clinical educator, right. They have to be checked off.
I'm talking specifically about the oral swab.
Yes. So the information that was provided through curative, through the training, they're trained at the facility level to perform the testing and obtaining the testing.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking that question for a specific reason, because if you look at the data that they have available, there's a huge difference in the false negative rate between a staff administered test and a self-administered test. The self-administered test has a false negative rate of about 35%. And the staff administered test has a false negative rate of about 10%.
Okay. No, we're thank you for bringing that up. I will make sure, but as we got these directives from the state of Florida, we are assisting with the staff testing for sure.
And Dr. Auslander, can you share that information? Is it on their website or is that?
I will send it to you, Diane. With respect to curative, their emergency use authorization I found on the website, and one of the people from the company who's helping with facilitating the testing in Florida sent me an abstract. The data are similar, relatively small numbers, but it's reassuring that using staff to administer the test, because I personally feel that staff should be tested twice a week. I know that's a huge burden and a cost, but every 2 weeks is not frequently enough. I think it's a step in the right direction. But and the oral swab makes that much more possible, as long as it's administered by somebody who's trained to do it. Otherwise, the false negative rate is too high. I'll send Absolutely. It to you, Diane, and you can disseminate you. It.
Perfect. And Liz, we had a question from Dr. Kaplan, Robert Kaplan, about if there was any, I guess, written policy around attending physicians face-to-face visits, or are they being allowed, or are those visits only for absolute emergencies?
It's going to vary from community to community, depending upon the outbreak and the prevalence of outbreak, but we are allowing our providers in, given the education that goes with it and the screening for a face-to-face visit, as well as, you know, moving to virtual or having a physician extender come in place of. So we do have screening in place to allow for that.
Perfect. Good. Any other questions?
Diane, it would probably go without saying that those providers will have now, as of the new executive order, will have to be tested on at least a minimum Q2-week basis, as Joe was making, any providers coming into either an ALF or a SNF.
Yes, absolutely agreed. And I think that's where some of our challenges are coming from. And per the Agency for Healthcare Administration, they basically did say, especially in their Q&A of last week, that whether it's a provider or whether it's staff from other facilities or home health that may have to come in for whatever, an episodic visit for someone that might have end of life, that we are to, you know, they've provided us with ample supplies from the curative to be able to test. So if we have a physician that's coming in to test them and say they visit another facility in the community, we would be able to provide them with the collaterals to show the other facility. So therefore they're only being tested once every 2 weeks. So the state has provided that for them. And we have some challenges where providers are not wanting to do the test across the board. So it's trying to get them to yes. And the reasoning why, just to decrease the obvious case of transmission.
So what's the turnaround for the curative test? Like how long before you get your results?
The turnaround has been just a few days. I know that our labs in the community, our nasopharyngeal that we do episodically for our residents, facility-wide testing, it's taking a lot of days now due to the influx of testing across the state. But curative, the turnaround has been just a few days. They have been great.
And we had another question about COVID positive staff. Are they allowed to work and treat COVID positive patients? I would assume if they're asymptomatic.
So per Surgeon General Rivkes, the answer would be no. Even if they're COVID positive, per the Department of Health, the Florida Department of Health, we have to wait at a minimum of 10 days with 72 hours free of symptoms in order for them to return. Now, with Greystone as a whole, as we all know, a return to work criteria is based upon a symptom-based or time-based strategy versus a test-based strategy. So your test-based strategy is so far left, which is two negative tests separated by 24 hours. And then to the right, it's the 10 days for the CDC with 72 hours free from symptoms. So we kind of use a combination to go above and beyond the symptom and the test-based requiring one negative test along with 10 days and 72 hours free from. But in those buildings, and you know, in your high prevalent areas, you know, going by at least what the CDC is recommending by symptom based, even if they're asymptomatic and they tested positive, we have to at least remove them from the schedule for a minimum of 10 days, 72 hours free from symptoms before returning. And if we do have a COVID positive unit in that particular building, we want to make sure that they are working on that unit in consistent assignments. And that would be the preference for sure.
Well, Liz, I agree too. I don't think we have any more questions in the chat. I don't know if anyone else has any questions, but I just want to thank you for joining us and giving us so much information. This was wonderful. The letter that you shared with me earlier today, it will be made available to our whole membership in our COVID-19 library. And I would just ask everyone who's on this call to read that. It is very touching to see, you know, how you care for your team. I just really appreciate that. And I thank you for doing this for us today.
Thank you so much. Really, it's been a pleasure. And thank you to all of the practitioners on the call. I can't thank you enough. And, you know, as we begin to navigate through all of this, it's, you know, getting back to that, you know, the human aspect of why we do what we do as clinicians every day in our lives and, you know, removing anything else that comes into play there. And I think that once we take care of that, we take care of people first and foremost, the rest takes care of itself. So again, thank you for your partnership. And thank you, doctor. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.